Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and I'm here with our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And making a long-awaited return to the studio, we have our Hollywood editor, Hillary Busis.
Thanks for having me.
Hillary, I'm just really just sorry we didn't bring you in for Mamma Mia week, since I know that was a totemic moment in your life.
It was. I'm still recovering. I don't know. I've changed. A lot of things about my life have changed.
Well, when its Oscar campaign starts up, we'll have you back on in like December to talk about its Golden Globes chances, et cetera.
I don't think there was an original song in there, so I'm very worried about its Oscar chances.
It's a real missed opportunity now that you think about it.
Could they nominate all three young guys like they did for like Billy Elliot or something, like at the Tonys?
they share an honorary Oscar, yeah. That's like Judy Garland's for right, Wizard of Oz.
Or what if they're all Mr. Golden Globe?
I would accept that wholeheartedly.
I would watch them handing everyone their Golden Globe statues.
Or maybe they sing Uptown Funk at the beginning of the show, like the Stranger Things kids at the Emmys.
They need to hire us for these things. So it is still the summer, and we still are not seeing a lot of Oscar potential movies in theaters, but there is a ton of award season news. In the last couple of days, many of the major fall festivals have announced at least parts of their lineup. So we're basically going to go in chronological order and talk about what's on these lineups, what that means, and what we're anticipating. And then from after that, we will talk about the summer blockbuster of the week that has everyone really excited, Mission Impossible Fallout. Best Tom Cruise stunt performance Oscar. They will make a whole category for it. But first, let's look a little bit ahead to September. Basically, we're just going to start in chronological order. So the major three fall festivals that we've talked about, you've got the Telluride and Venice Film Festival over Labor Day weekend, and then you've got Toronto after that. Telluride famously doesn't announce its lineup until about a week before, but we do have the
Day
Venice...
of.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. So Richard is on his way to Telluride when he finds out what he's going to be seeing.
They love drama, Telluride.
They really do. But you can kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll talk about
it as we go. Well, yeah, so we've got what happened today as we're recording this is the Venice Film Festival announced its lineup, which is happening relatively simultaneously with Telluride. They tend to have a lot of good European films. They tend to have a lot of good films in general. This year's lineup is pretty exceptional. The one that stood out for me, and I think a lot of us, is the Coen Brothers movie that we didn't even know was a movie. I think a lot of people thought it was going to be a Netflix limited series called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and it turns out it's going to be an anthology film. What else stood out for you guys on this lineup?
I mean, I'm still just really excited about A Star is Born. I know that that is probably the most basic answer possible to that question, but I just really want to see it. I'm so curious about this movie. The Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper remake.
I kind of thought they might hold it because it's a Warner Brothers release. It's got big stars. It doesn't need festival buzz, but it does seem like there's a level of confidence in it that it's going to all of these big festivals.
Right, and I think I've already read that they started showing it to distributors who apparently have had a very positive reaction to the movie, so I guess maybe that boosted their confidence even further and made them decide to, like, really give it a push.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, a musical called La La Land debuted at Venice, you know, a couple years ago, and I just think, I think that it's a festival movie indicates to me that that there's reason for its aspirations, you know, like
it's not just Lady Gaga made a movie, that
right.
This is an awards a real contender.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, again, I did talk to someone who saw it, and he was, you know, saying its praises in certain areas. So I'm really curious about that. And I feel like an international European audience in particular, like, they're kind of cheese balls over there. So, like, I feel like they might just
exhibit
like,
A, really... Mamma Mia, exhibit B, Mamma Mia 2, here we go again.
Exactly. I feel like they really might go for it. And then so it'll like kick the movie off. Like, it'll give it some good momentum as it enters the fall season.
The Hollywood Foreign Press is the people that gave Lady Gaga her Golden Globe, right?
Get ready for her second. Like, if she doesn't win it, I think they're going to burn
it. I think she already won. I think that there was a press release about that.
All right, Richard, what stood out for you at the Venice lineup?
We talked about the trailer last week, but I'm really curious about The Favorite, the Yorgos Lanthimos movie. But one that kind of snuck in, and I don't know if it's going to be at other festivals, is Paul Greengrass's movie, 22 July, which is, just a cheery comedy about the Norwegian terror attacks a few years ago. I did speak to a publicist for the movie a couple weeks ago, and she told me that, I mean, it's her job to tell me it's good, but what she described to me was not just, you know, it wasn't 90 minutes of like a terrorist attack. It's actually more about what Norway did afterward to kind of come together as a community and to prosecute the guy who did it. And, you know, given that he's like a neo-Nazi, blah, 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 like there's sadly, some really pertinent relevance to today. So I'm really curious about that. And then Vox Lux, which is another musical, I think, with Natalie Portman.
There should just be a musical film festival. I would be there every day.
That's actually a brilliant idea. It stars Natalie Portman as a pop singer. It's billed as a musical on IMDb. Jude Law is in it, Jennifer Jason Leigh. And it's directed by Brady Corbett, who we mostly know as an actor from Funny Games and various other things, Clouds of Sils Maria. But he directed in 2015 a movie called The Childhood of a Leader, which was really well received by some. It's kind of a sort of pretentious art house piece. Anyway, I'm very curious about that. I feel like that could be like a slow burn kind of like dark horse contender for something. Maybe Natalie Portman, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And kind of buried a little bit below the films, I guess, because it's playing out of competition, there's going to be preview of My Brilliant Friend, the HBO Elena Ferrante adaptation, which I'm very curious about.
I'm going to go pick a couple of like fancy director titles, which God knows when we'll see them. Some of them may come out next year. But you've got the first film from Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck since The Tourist, which was kind of his follow up to The Lives of Others, which was this huge, like successful German film. The Tourist was a disaster. So it's interesting to see if he can make a comeback there. Jennifer Kent, the director of The Babadook, has a film in competition. The only woman with a film in competition, which is its own thing. And then I'm really excited to see the film from Laszlo Nemes, I think he's a Hungarian director, who made Son of Saul, which was incredibly grim, kind of in the Paul Greengrass style, just deep dive into human depravity. But he's got a new film coming, so I'm intrigued to see. And it has to be lighter than Son of Saul. I don't think there's an option, so we'll see what happens with that.
The exciting thing about this lineup and the Toronto lineup, which we'll talk about, is that this year was so weird because there really was not a big awards contender that came out of Sundance. There really wasn't one that came out of Cannes. There wasn't one of the South by Southwest, really. So, like, it's just, like, I guess we have Black Panther. That's one we think is in the Best Picture race. But, like, beyond that, like, all of this is, like, new, exciting, like, haven't seen it stuff. Yeah, so, I mean, it's really, I wish I was going to Venice, frankly, but maybe next year.
Well, the idea of a late summer in Europe is always appealing. And speaking of Cannes, it's notable that you've got several Netflix titles here after Cannes had its whole blow up with Netflix this year. You've got the Alfonso Cuarón movie.
Yeah,
you've got the Paul Greengrass movie. I think there's a couple, My Brilliant Friend is HBO. So they're embracing Netflix and can kind of position themselves as competitors to Cannes in that way, which is smart. Why not? Should we move on to Toronto? Let's do it. Well, there's a little bit of overlap between them. We should mention that. I think First Man, the Damien Chazelle, Neil Armstrong movie, The Sisters Brothers, which is the Western from Jacques Audiard, possibly a few others will be at Toronto as well as Venice. But there's a ton of other stuff to dig into from Toronto. So what grabbed your attention?
Well, it's kind of a Toronto Telluride mashup. So on the Toronto billing, this movie, The Frontrunner, directed by Jason Reitman, starring Hugh Jackman, based on the true story about Gary Hart, the politician in the 80s, that it says international premiere, so we can kind of divine from that it's going to be a Telluride, because it would say world premiere if it wasn't. Anyway, it's kind of complicated, silly logic. But I'm really curious about that, not because, you know, Jason Reitman had some dark years post Up in the Air, I would say. But Tully was really great this spring. Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman, you know, kind of weirdly under the radar, had a huge year last year with Greatest Showman and Logan, like two of the biggest movies of the year, you know, one of them at least critically lauded.
I think The Greatest Showman might still be in theaters. I think people love that movie.
Oh, people love that movie. If you go on YouTube, everyone's doing covers of songs. Like, it was a cultural phenomenon that I think maybe either over or under people's heads. So anyway, he's riding high. here's now an Oscar-y kind of like political drama with Vera Farmiga's in it. Maybe it's Jason Reitman's, you know, sort of Oscar-y comeback. He used to make movies that got nominated for tons of Oscars. So,
and he's a Toronto native son, we should note, so he'll get a warm reception no matter what.
The party will probably be at Montecito, which is his dad's restaurant right behind where everything screens. So anyway, it's more of a mainstream kind of like traditional Oscar thing, but I am really curious about it. And now that it's being positioned as a Telluride and then a Toronto movie, like, clearly someone behind it has hopes for it.
Yeah, definitely. I can't stop thinking about Widows. That's like top of my list. So Widows, written by Gillian Flynn, directed by Steve McQueen. Oh, I think Gillian Flynn and Steve McQueen actually wrote it together, which is even better. Viola Davis is in there, Cynthia Erivo, Andre Holland. I mean, it's a great cast. It's a really interesting kind of storyline. It's an original movie, which is exciting. I am very, I don't know, it's been a while since Gillian Flynn has, like, produced anything. She's been kind of working on this show with David Fincher for a long time that we haven't seen yet. She's got this movie. I'm, like, very excited for her to be back in the mainstream. Like, it's her year. Sharp Objects in this.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think the big question is, you know, or was like, is this movie an awards movie? Is it just purely commercial? It's from Warner Brothers. But I don't know, putting it at Toronto, like, that feels like they're maybe angling for something.
For something Gone Girl-esque that is both awardsy and blockbuster.
Exactly.
I mean, ideally.
No, there's no reason not to. Like, that template is right there for them. Mm-hmm. I was really intrigued and maybe a little bit surprised to see The Hate U Give on the Toronto lineup. I think, like, to me, I was thinking of it. It's this adaptation of this really successful young adult book. So I was like, okay, you know, the Love, Simon mold, but a little bit more serious. And George Tillman Jr. has had a really long career as director, but not necessarily doing awards season-y stuff. But it does seem like it's so topical. It's about, I haven't read the book, but it's about a girl who, I think her classmate is killed by police and is kind of coping with that. I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of faith in this, and that TIFF slot really says that.
Yeah, and so the book it's based on is huge. So I don't know if listeners remember, because I plugged it a bunch, but I had a young adult novel come out earlier this year. And
I didn't hear about that.
No, yeah, all we can do is wait, and stars now. But in my sort of toe dipping, let's say, into the YA world, it was immediately like apparent, like, that book was the first book anyone mentioned, whether it was a young reader, whether it was a person who worked, you know, in behind the scenes in publishing, whether it was a bookseller. Like, The Hate U Give is a huge, huge, like, pervasive cultural kind of thing, maybe more for young readers than adults. So, yeah, I think that they're positioning that movie. I think they have high hopes for it. Again, I talked to a publicist for it, and she was kind of touting it, which, again, is her job. But, like, I don't think that that's one that we can kind of discount in any way as just, like, a YA adaptation. I think it's more than that.
Yeah, and its star, Amandla Sundberg, is one of the biggest young activists among this, like, new generation of stars who are also very politically active. And, you know, she's got a huge social media following. And so I think that that will also probably boost its chances. If nothing else, this movie, I think, is going to do very well at the box office.
I'm just waiting for a lot of old Academy voters to get their screeders and be like, what is this? And have no idea.
Be like,
how to
wait, The
it.
Hate U Give is an acronym? Because I didn't realize that until I saw the trailer.
I literally just realized that right now.
Okay, so at least I'm not alone in being old and stupid.
It's possible we have things to learn from this movie.
You guys need to go to more YA book events.
Yes. So.
No, please don't go to those.
I want to ask The Room how we're feeling about life itself. I don't think we've talked about that trailer, which really just seemed to say this is us, the movie. And it's got a lot of Toronto, which I think suggests some faith in it, but also it's worth remembering. Toronto gets huge audiences and gets all these people who live around the city, and kind of heartwarming films can really do well there, even if they're not necessarily embraced by critics. I don't want to say that for Life Itself, because who knows, but it did seem to be kind of like so cheesy and manipulative that I wasn't sure what to make of it. But I don't know. They're asking us to consider it.
I mean, here's what I'll say about that. A, Oscar Isaac, like, you know, can do no wrong in my mind.
Yes. Yeah. B, the only person who says the things that Oscar Isaac says in that trailer and would not seem like a serial killer is
Oscar Isaac.
Who says,
I am going
Oscar
to ask
Isaac.
You out and then marry you and you have no choice.
Yes, immediately.
So the trailer begins with this horrible monologue where he basically tells a woman that apparently he's never asked out on a date, that he's like, well, the reason I've waited is because when I do ask you on a date, like, you're mine forever. Like, it's horrifying.
He's like the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah. And there's this, like, wistful sort of indie kind of Mumfordy song playing. So I watched the trailer and I was like, oh, this is so stupid. But I hate this so much. Laugh at it. I sent it to my sister being like, you have to watch this awful trailer. Laugh at it. And then I kind of watched it a second time while she watched it for a first time, like over GChat. And I got teary watching it the second time.
He like, got you. Fogelman got
that's
you.
That's how they get you.
So I think it's going to be probably pretty bad. But, like, I will happily be there at the press screening ready to be proven wrong.
I will admit to having liked Crazy Stupid Love.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... You know, there's possibilities there.
Can't you see yourself after, like, 5 days of festival films of, like, you know, horrifying Holocaust dramas or whatever, and then, like, settling down for that screening and being like, oh, thank God, this feels so much better.
I love you too, yeah. Oscar Isaac.
it'll go down like butter. No, I mean, I think you're right, Katie, that, like, it's definitely a populist play at that festival. You can't just only serve art house. TIFF is a huge business, and the reason they have so many movies is because... They charge a lot of money for tickets, and you know it's a big economic thing for the city, and so you have to kind of have your world premiere of Mia Hansen Love's new movie weighed out by This Is Us, the motion picture.
Can we talk about If Beale Street Could Talk? Because I think it's no surprise to see it on these festival lineups, but based on it being a world premiere, it seems like it won't be at Telluride, which is a festival Barry Jenkins, the director, has a ton of history with. So Richard, you had a theory on this, I think.
Well, I had heard that it wasn't ready for Telluride, and it's only like a few days apart, but maybe that's a crucial number of days. Because Telluride, like, he used to work there. His films have premiered there. Last year, he introduced Lady Bird at the world premiere at Telluride. You know, it just kind of flew in to do this like kind of favor for the festival. So it seemed like a natural fit that he would be there. But yeah, I don't really know like beyond the sort of timing of it, why that would be. But I'm glad that we're going to get it.
Yeah, you were kind of worried it wouldn't be out this year at all, I think. Or you had me worried about that, so I'm glad that it's coming.
And especially because there was like a sort of an embargoed press release that went out to some press the day before the announcement of the TIFF lineup, and it wasn't on there. And I was like, oh man, so it's just not going anywhere. But I'm really glad we get to see it. It's, you know, it's an adaptation of James Baldwin's story. It's like got a great cast, and a follow-up is always interesting, whether it's a good or bad follow-up, who knows, but it's always kind of an interesting narrative.
I'm just excited to see Damien Chazelle and Barry Jenkins at all of the same awards events a couple of years after the envelope drop heard around the world.
It's them together again, and Lucas Hedges and Timothée Chalamet both having movies this fall. There's just something so nice about these pairs that we, you know, put together, at least in our minds. But although Damien Chazelle and Barry Jenkins do seem to be genuinely friends.
Well, and speaking of Lucas Hedges, though, Boy Erased hasn't been on any of these big festival lineups yet, which is kind of a surprise.
Yeah, I had my little list of what we haven't seen yet. And I think a lot of them, like, you know, these are initial lineups for TIFF. Like, TIFF is a massive festival, so there'll be a lot added to it. It does seem like Boy Erased could show up later on. But so Focus Features has that as well as On the Basis of Sex. And I think also Mary Queen of Scots. And I believe none of them have been on any of these lineups. So there's a strategy here for sure. But it would surprise me if all three of them stayed out of festivals entirely.
Yeah. Boy Erased, I feel like, has to play somewhere. If only because it's kind of thunder has been stolen by the
Miseducation of Cameron Post,
which is another gay therapy movie. So, yeah, I think that'll end up somewhere. But, yeah, the focus playing this game, like, I'm really shocked to not see Mary Queen of Scots on any of these lineups yet.
Especially because they released the trailer a week or two ahead.
Yeah.
And character posters, they seem to be setting it up for a very big campaign.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that means it'll be at AFI, if it'll be at New York Film Festival, or it will just be added later. But, you know, I have to kind of halt this conversation because we have not yet talked about the biggest movie at Toronto, which is a movie directed by none other than Sir Trevor Nunn. It's called Red Joan, and it stars Judi Dench as a Russian spy.
Oh, wow.
Is that not the Toronto-iest movie you've ever heard of?
I mean, is it like in the same year as Red Sparrow? Can we handle Red Joan and Red Sparrow?
I'm assuming it's a sequel. So, like, the one.
Jennifer Lawrence ages into.
A sparrow ages into a Joan. I'm assuming that's what it's about.
That common.
that old progression. That old saying.
So, Trevor Nunn, it seems, has directed one other feature. He's got a huge, long theater directing career, but this is his second feature film, it seems.
He's Mamma Mia, right? On Broadway? Or not? No, that's Phil DeLa. But he's, like, done big musicals. Like, he's done, like.
He did Oklahoma. IMDb is not useful for this, but anyway, he's
big intriguing. Deal. Yeah. Anyway, it's just like this very Toronto-y movie that I will be at the very first press screening for, much like I was a few years ago for the Blake Lively Blindness movie, which actually Ollie CSU, which actually turned out to be pretty good. So
Well, that reminds me, in a couple months we'll be having our exclusively, the Blake Lively and a Kendrick movie. We'll have an entire episode.
A simple favor.
Yeah, we'll have, I think, maybe 3 weeks of episodes devoted to that. So,
well, that's opening our film
festival. Yes, exactly.
That we started.
At Richard's apartment.
Yes, exactly. I stole a print of it.
The other things I had on my list of things that I was looking for, I'm curious about Mid-90s, the Jonah Hill movie that released a trailer yesterday. I think the same day.
And did anyone know that existed?
I had heard.
I didn't until I got a release about it.
It was kind of like a Lady Bird last year where it just sort of dropped. But you'd heard
something. I heard just that it existed at some point. Someone mentioned it. It does seem to me like that Lady Bird model is going to hold. It'll show up at Telluride and then possibly also at TIFF later. It's hard for me to imagine it'll skip all the festivals. And then I'm still curious about what's going to go on with the Dick Cheney movie. I think we talked about it last week and how it's called Backseat for reasons I can't figure out. But when do we think that's going to show up?
When Adam McKay did The Big Short, that like waited until like, what is it, AFI in LA, right? And like, which is like later in the fall. So I feel like it'll just like end up at that kind of thing. It'll be like a
later thing. Oh, I forgot about AFI.
That seems like the kind of movie.
Being like a good, I just finished my movie slot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like the kind of movie that is not like literally ready yet, like has not been printed yet.
Right. And I believe Backseat's Backseat Driver.
Oh.
Because Cheney, that's my only guess. I don't know.
But I hope they change it. But
if anything, he was a front seat driver.
He was right there.
He was the car.
I guess shot a man in the face was not catchy enough too long.
He has no pulse. He is actually a monster.
Zero heart. Right. Heartless.
There you go.
Zero heart 30. Call me, Adam McKay.
Our friend Joe Reed of the This Had Oscar Buzz podcast had a pretty strong theory. I thought that Welcome to Marwen, the Robert Zemeckis movie, would be the closing night of the New York Film Festival, where The Walk definitely played, Flight definitely played. They've got a good track record with Zemeckis.
The Walk was opening,
And so far with New York Film Festival, we have The Favorite as the opener and then Roma as the centerpiece, and both of them will have been at other festivals. So maybe Welcome to Marwen is the big debut that they're going to have.
Yeah, that seems like it likely. And another movie that I noticed that I think is going to be at Telluride, just judging by the sort of language, and that's definitely at Toronto, is White Boy Rick.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Which stars Matthew McConaughey. It's kind of this, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, Bruce Stern. It's kind of a crime drama. There's a trailer out for it. It looks kind of gritty. Oh, Brian Tyree Henry's in it.
Does McConaughey play White Boy Rick?
No, I believe he's White Boy Rick's dad.
Oh, no.
And I can't find on IMDb who plays the titular Rick. I think it might be a newcomer kid. But anyway, so it's directed by Jan Demange. Demange?
Sure.
Who made 71 a couple years ago with Jack O'Connell, which is sort of a Northern Irish, sort of behind enemy lines thriller that's actually really good. So the fact that it's going to be at Telluride is interesting to me. I mean, look, you know, Hostels was at Telluride last year and that didn't do anything. So sometimes they have to throw a sort of butch movie for the old men who spend thousands of dollars to go to Telluride. They have to just toss
one. Who didn't want to see I, Tonya.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm just curious about it, as yet another in this jumble of titles that, have been not, glimpsed by anyone at any festival yet.
Does anyone have a theory on whether The Irishman, the Martin Scorsese Netflix movie, is going to come out this year? Because it's nowhere to be found in any of these lineups. It does seem like something that could they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on CGI.
Well, yeah, how long does it take to age down, De Niro?
I mean, as long as he
how
wants,
hard is that dial to turn?
I would still guess it's going to show up, but also Netflix is busy this year, so if they wanted to hold it, it seems like they had plenty else to campaign.
If they want to throw their entire budget behind an Oscar campaign for Set It Up, for example, they could.
Exactly.
They could easily do that.
I mean, Glenn Powell, Golden Globe comedy nomination? I mean, I would say it. I'm curious about that one, and there's another one, a friend of the podcast, James Gray, has a space movie called Ad Astra that stars Brad Pitt that I kind of thought we were going to see on one of these lists, and we have not. So maybe it's just not ready. Who knows? But
no, that whole generation's going to space. Sean Penn is in that new Hulu astronaut show.
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's finally time.
It's the final frontier, I guess.
And may they never come back.
That seems like something that could show up at Cannes next year, too, because James Gray is famously beloved in France, more so than we appreciate him here, which is a shame. But yeah, I forgot to be anticipating that one.
Well, the big question for a lot of colleagues that I've talked to who are going to Toronto and not any of the other festivals is, where is Suspiria, which is Luca Guadagnino's follow-up to Call Me By Your Name, and a remake of the classic 70s horror Italian horror film. It will be at Venice, because how could it not
be?
It is Italian to its bones. But nowhere else yet has been announced, and I'm really, really hoping that I get a chance to see it, you know, at one of these festivals. But I also just really want to know if it's, like, at all awards worthy or if it's just going to be, like, because it could be Mother, mm-hmm. which, you know, premiered at Venice last year, screened at Toronto, and then
which was the best comedy of 2017 right. and should have gotten more recognition.
I mean, if anything, brace your sinks, everyone. But, yeah, so I don't know. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, it could also be a bigger splash. You know, Luca Guadagnino's previous movie that was really well-liked but just didn't have awards traction. It's coming out in the fall. It's on the heels of Call Me By Your Name. It seems like he's past that point. But you're right that it doesn't have to be a slam dunk to be worthy or interesting to talk about. All right, so Richard, you will be at Telluride and then also Toronto. We'll have coverage from all of these festivals. So everyone should just keep an eye out on, spend your Labor Day weekend indoors reading Richard's reviews from Telluride.
That's
what we'll all be doing. So make it worth Richard's while.
And Cam Collins will be reviewing from Toronto as well. So we'll have two people kind of. We're going to fight over a Star Is Born review.
Publish a transcript of that fight, please. And
we should do dueling reviews, actually.
Oh, that would be great.
What if both reviews are just like, holy shit?
Two gay critics talk about a Star Is Born.
One of you can review the Barbara one. One of you can review the Judy one. And then you can do a back and forth for Gaga.
Or I'll review Gaga. He'll review Bradley Cooper or something.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So let's get back to the present day. We have a gigantic, well-liked blockbuster coming to theaters this week, which is a really special thing. It's been a pretty decent summer for blockbusters, but it's hard to find one where critics are really excited and it seems like audiences will go too. And Hillary and Richard, you guys both, as far as I know, really were way on board with Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yeah, definitely. Richard, you called it the best action movie of the year.
Yeah, I mean, because it is. I mean, it's so fun. And these movies have, with the exception maybe of two, which is John Woo's installment in the franchise, and that's actually up for some debate right now. People are sort of like reassessing that one. But like, this is a great franchise. They're really fun movies. Christopher McQuarrie, who directed it and wrote the movie, has become a sort of Tom Cruise go-to in terms of a writer and director. He won an Oscar years ago for writing The Usual Suspects. And this one just, I don't know, it figured out, like, oh, there is no sort of limit to this stuff. Tom Cruise will literally do anything. He plans to die.
They're going to shoot Tom Cruise into space eventually, too.
Fully into space. He plans to die making one of these movies. And so they're just like, all right, well, we're just going to keep, you know, ratcheting up the spectacle. And so the stunt work in this movie is crazy. The action scenes go on about two beats longer than you expect them to, but in a good way. I don't know. I just had so much fun. I mean, Hillary, we saw it in IMAX, which I feel like helped a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And I came to this as not a big Mission Impossible person, just in that, you know, I think I saw the first one when it came out decades ago. I saw Ghost Protocol, but I don't have a very, like, deep knowledge of the Mission Impossible cinematic universe. And it didn't really matter, which is another great thing that in an age where blockbusters can get a little serialized. I mean, you know, you go into the Avengers,
Infinity War?
Infinity War. I was going to say Ultron, and that's, that's much longer ago. Yeah. But yeah, so you go into Infinity War, and if you haven't seen 20 other movies, you're going to have no idea who any of these people are or what they're doing or, you know, what are the, like, little glowing rocks they're all so jazzed about. But Mission Impossible, that doesn't really matter, and that's kind of refreshing in an age where movies are getting more like TV and TV is getting more like movies. This is very clearly a movie and very clearly doing something that it does very well.
Are you guys on board with this theory that I keep popping up that Mission Impossible is just like low-key the best franchise we have? Like, it doesn't get the same attention as the Avengers and the comic book movies of it, but the consistency of the quality is so above anything anyone else is doing.
And there aren't that many of them, so it's not like a Star Wars where, you know, Solo was perfectly fine, but there are just too many Star Wars movies, and I really think that that's why that ended up flopping. Like, Mission Impossible waits long enough in between installments for you to get excited for the next
one. Well, Tom Cruise has to, like, literally, like, put himself in a cryo bath to be physically able to do it.
I think it's a prestige, like, thing where, like, in that movie, I think it's just clones. We're just seeing he dies every time he makes these.
That would make so much sense.
That's not my joke. I think that's David Sims' joke. I have to give someone credit for it. But I think, you know,
he just runs so much that another Cruise springs off of
right,
him.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's a whole physics thing. But, you know, I guess maybe you could make an argument for Fast and Furious. Maybe you could make an argument for the Harry Potter movies. But in terms of extant, you know, right now, original-ish stuff, like, yeah, I think that the, you know, basically from 3 on, and the first one's great too, but the first one's a very different movie. And that's kind of why people are reassessing the second one as this kind of crux point where it turned the franchise into an action franchise versus like a spy thriller, which the first one very much is. So I don't know. Anyway, but I think that they've been great. They've been great in different ways, each one. You know, Ghost Protocol, which was in 2013.
I think
2011. 2011? Gosh, really?
Age has come for us.
I just remember I saw two women at the press screening I went to almost literally get in a physical fight over a seat at that screening. But that was Brad Bird making his live action debut and had such personality because of that. And now we've got McQuarrie doing his thing. And so, yeah, like it's slightly auteurish, this franchise, which is interesting. And at the center of it all, despite personal life, whatever you want to say about Tom Cruise, outside of his presence in movies, like, man, is like, you watch this movie and you're like, this guy, he's just a movie star for very palpable reasons.
The amazing thing about this franchise that I think it's easy to forget since Ghost Protocol was such a huge hit is that that movie was supposed to be Jeremy Renner taking over for Tom Cruise. Like, that was because it was, you know, still relatively in the wake of all the Scientology, Katie Holmes stuff. Like, it just seemed like he was on his way out. And Tom Cruise kind of.
And he was in the last one, too, the one between Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, with three, which did
Fallout.
Well. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah,
he was.
Rogue
Nation.
So Jeremy Renner was still hanging around there, but just it seems like Tom Cruise, through sheer force of will, was like, no, I'm not giving this up, and I'm going to jump off buildings to prove that I'm still a movie star, and it works. It's
well, yeah, and didn't and Matt Damon took the Bournes back from Jeremy Renner, too, eventually.
Yeah, Renner, things didn't quite pan out, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They've tried different stuff with these movies. They've added cast members like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as a kind of sidekick and Maggie Q and Jeremy Renner. And, you know, but he and Ving Rhames have really remained the only constants. And now Rebecca Ferguson has kind of joined that company. She's been
and
in
Simon
the last
Pegg
two.
Has Her, been in the last three,
Simon Pegg,
four?
Yeah. That was J.J. Abrams. Yeah. He brought him on. Vanessa Kirby from The Crown is in this one, and I
and hopefully in the next.
There's no reason to think she won't be in the next one. That's not a spoiler, I don't think. They're playing with the kind of people around him, but it's so clear, especially in this one, that like Tom Cruise is absolutely the crucial center of this, you know, this franchise.
And in 50 years, his hologram will still be starring in them.
Absolutely,
doing even more death-defying stunts.
Is it worth me asking what this movie is about?
Certainly not.
I haven't really
been able to figure it out. And it does seem like it doesn't matter. Like, even the most glowing reviews are like, yeah, it's excuse for the action sequences. But
there is kind of a Unabomber-esque figure, I guess, that they're trying to hunt down. He has this manifesto about, I mean, it's pretty standard action movie villain
anarchists
stuff. Yeah, you know, burning everything down to, like, rebuild anew. But it doesn't matter. I mean, you've got Cruise, you've got Henry Cavill's mustache, you've got...
Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about Henry Cavill.
No, we didn't. And
I wanted to ask about Henry
he's
Cavill.
He's very fun
and
in this movie.
The contractually mandated mustache.
So I had a very poorly timed tweet. The night before the interview he gave where he talked about me, you know, like dating women and how, you know, he's scared to date people because he's, you know, because of Me Too or whatever.
Worried that people are going to accuse him of sexual misconduct if he, like, says hello.
Something rational about that. So that happened on like a Wednesday morning, but the night before we had seen the movie and I was tweeting excitedly about it because the embargo had lifted or whatever. And one of my tweets was, I'm working on a theory that Henry Cavill's a genius. Because he's so good in the movie.
He's so much better than he ever was as Superman.
Oh, yeah. So much.
It's night and day.
Well, what it is it's a continuation of him and the man
from I was just going to ask if it's Man from U.N.C.L.E. Henry Cavill.
I mean, it's a little less like arch and wry than that movie, which everyone should see, by the way. That's a very underlooked summer movie from years past. But you know, it's not. I don't think it's a spoiler. It's in the trailers. He's kind of the villain or one of the villains anyway. And he plays it perfectly well because he's so good looking and like wholesome seeming that having him like tweaked just a little bit with the mustache and like to be bad, it just works really well. And it's kind of like a joke in a way that I think Henry Cavill seems in on, which is fun.
Yeah, and the movie generally has a pretty good sense of humor, which you wouldn't always expect from some giant tentpole like this. And Henry Cavill's role a lot of the time is not in like an annoying Deadpool kind of way, but to point out how ridiculous the impossible missions force is in the first place, how all they do is, you know, put on silly masks and like
you
run
really don't
around.
Like those masks.
I love the masks. I think the masks are so funny. They're so Scooby-Doo.
Well, I remember when Ghost Protocol came out, like there's a whole scene where they're trying to use the mask and the machine breaks, so they never use the masks at all in that. And it seemed to me like they might be moving away from it in the franchise. But I'm glad to hear that they're sticking with it, because I think you're right, Hillary, that the silliness of them is a huge part of the appeal.
There's one mask bit at the top of the film that, like, I will not spoil it, but, like, it's bizarre.
It had me on the floor.
It's like a cameo that you're like, of all the cameos? it's great. And I think, yeah, you're speaking to the sense of humor, Hillary, like, I mean, granted, we were at a free press screening, so people are sort of worked up in a different way. I think there was free popcorn.
There was popcorn in this one, which does not always happen.
No, that was nice. People were, like, laughing at the end of big action sequences because they were so, like, giddy and, like, fun.
And just, like, the release of tension, because it does a great job of building that.
Yeah, and building and building and building. It really coils tight. So it's just, like, a really viscerally fun thing. I don't often say this because it's, like, it costs more money and, you know, it's expensive to go to movies. But, like, if you can see it in IMAX, like, I would recommend it because it's just like having this already crazy spectacle be that much bigger is just a lot of fun.
And this is, I think, a movie that probably loses something if you watch it on a laptop screen, on a phone.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to be like locked into it. You can't be distracted.
In a dark room.
Yeah.
You have to have an enormous popcorn.
Like, have Tom Cruise's level of commitment to watching his movies. It kind of seems like the least you can do. He broke himself.
If you don't leave your screening.
He literally snapped himself in half for your amusement.
Yeah. Pony up the 1750.
If you have MoviePass, you can wait until the off-peak hours and see it then.
I just looked up my when the earliest I can see it. I think it might be the last thing I do before I leave for vacation, which just seems correct. Like, that's how you should spend your summer, right?
Oh, yeah. That'll usher in a vacation well, especially if you're going to the mountains of Kashmir.
I am. How did you guess? That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you, as always, for listening. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Give us a rating. Give us a review. Tweet at us. Help us build the word. You can find us all at vanityfair.com, writing about Mission Impossible and awards movies and so many other things. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men. And on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. Richard.
Rye Laws.
And Hillary.
Hillabuster with two R's because one R was taken.
This week's episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth, and this week's award for the best description of how Red Sparrow turns into Red Joan goes to Richard Lawson.
It's kind of complicated, silly logic.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.